In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Thursday, September 11th, 2014. We're talking John Stuart Mill today. John Stuart Mill and the Religion of Humanity. That's the title of a book by our guest Linda Rader, who's a professor at Palm Beach Atlantic University. Here is a side of Mill you probably have not heard before. This is the kind of thing we do on this show all the time. So, of course, make sure and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so you're getting your daily dose of liberty education Monday through Friday. And, of course, make sure and get our free ebook of all the transcripts of all the interviews I did in 2013 on this show. That book is a veritable primer of liberty in its own right. Think of all the great guests, all the interesting topics, all available for free. No obligation to do anything. Nothing. Nothing. Just go to tomwoods.com/woodsbook, and you got it. You got it in PDF. You got it in a Nook format, if that's what you want for some reason. And you got it in Kindle format. How great. All right, let's get back to our guest now. Linda Rader is an associate professor of political science at Palm Beach Atlantic University. Since 1994, she's been associate editor of Humanitas, which is published by the National Humanities Institute. The book we're talking about today is John Stuart Mill and the Religion of Humanity. Linda Rader, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning. How are you, Tom?
Well, doing very well. I was just mentioning to you before we went on together that as I've been thinking about guests to bring on, I've been thinking in terms of books that I've read over the years that really surprised me or startled me or that I learned something from. And I thought about your book, John Stuart Mill and the Religion of Humanity. And so I wanted to have you on to talk about that because the thesis in there is quite interesting, quite provocative. And John Stuart Mill is, of course, considered to be an icon in some ways in the liberal canon. So it's important for my audience to hear this material in particular. So let's start off with the most basic of questions. Who was John Stuart Mill?
Well, as you're right, you know, Mill, as you said, is widely regarded, and I had this opinion of him when I began my research, as sort of, you know, the last great classical liberal thinker in the Anglo-American tradition. You know, he was a pivotal figure in the 19th century. I mean, he was the sage of England, the mentor to the world. I mean, he's written his most well-known essay, of course, is On Liberty, which almost everyone has read and everyone loves. And so Mill has the reputation for being a great champion of individual liberty, and I think even among, you know, libertarians and classical liberals and so forth. So I had someone had once suggested to me in casual conversation that no one had ever done anything on the religious thought of John Stuart Mill, and I thought, well, you know, that's a perfect topic for me. I love him. I'm a student of Hayek, and Hayek, you know, one of Hayek's hobbies was he used to collect the private letters of John Stuart Mill and his wife, Harriet Taylor. And I thought, well, you know, that would be a perfect project for me. I like to work with people I admire, and I thought I'll do Mill's religious thought. Well, in Mill's case, I have to say, my opinion of him dramatically revised with increasing familiarity with his actual work, especially, and this I think is the reason for why my research was so novel, is that recently, when I began research, Mill's private correspondence with Auguste Comte, the French thinker, had just recently been translated from French to English. And previous scholars, most of them, you know, in the Anglo-American tradition, don't speak French and didn't have access to that work. And what I discovered, and I'm sad even to this day, I'm not happy about this, is that Mill is not what he portrayed himself to be. He was not really, in the end, a friend of liberty. And it's related to his, what can only be regarded as his religious mission. Mill's lifelong purpose, and I would even say his overarching purpose, was to remove or eliminate the vestiges of Christianity from Anglo-American society, Western society, and replace it with a new religion. What he adopted, the so-called religion of humanity that he adopted from Comte. And Mill spent his entire life, from the time he was a very young man to the very last essay he wrote, in attempting to realize that goal. And most importantly, and for me what was most disappointing, is that he was not above manipulating his audience by using his allegedly philosophical works as actual tools of to further his reform mission, his religious mission. He's sort of like Marx. You know how Marx once said that the purpose of philosophy is not to understand the world, but rather to change it? Well, unfortunately, I think Mill was doing the same thing. He was disingenuous in some of his works. They were manipulative. They were deliberately designed to, as a strategy, to lead the reader to the conclusions that he wanted. Anyways, he talks about this openly in his letters, about how he has to keep silence on the question of religion because no one will read him, but that he can surreptitiously lead people to these conclusions all the same. I mean, it's a very sad story, actually. And so at the end of the day, I've lost respect for Mill. And he's not true, and I'll get into this if you're interested in why his religious mission is bound up with his ultimate abandonment of the principle of liberty.
I do want to get into that. I want to share with you something. Thankfully, this book was within reach here at my desk, Classical Economics by Murray Rothbard. It's volume 2 of his Austrian Perspective on the History of Economic Thought. I don't suppose you've seen this book, have you? Because otherwise, this would be this is going to be a wonderful surprise for you then. I'm glad you haven't, because in the bibliographical essay, you will love this one sentence. Rothbard writes, "It is difficult to think of anyone in the history of thought who has been more egregiously and systematically overestimated as an economist, as a political philosopher, as an overall thinker, or as a man, than John Stuart Mill."
Well, you know, I love Rothbard. I met him shortly before he died, and what an outstanding, wonderful scholar!
Oh, absolutely!
Well, thank you, Mary, wherever you are. Well,
But can you believe he writes sentences like that even in a bibliographical essay? It goes to show you can't skip any part of a Rothbard book, even the bibliographical essay. You have to read.
Yeah.
All right, but before we get into the religious aspect, which of course is the key to your book, I do want to ask a little bit more about Mill's views on liberty, because I think they are relevant to some modern libertarian controversies. And let me describe one of those controversies, and you see if you recognize in this themes from Mill. There has arisen over the past, I don't know how many years, a disagreement among libertarians who, some of whom call themselves thick libertarians and others call themselves thin libertarians. The thin libertarians say that the libertarian view is about non-aggression. It's not about telling people how to live. It's not about non-conformity. It's not about individualism even, really. It's just about non-aggression. If you want to go live in a commune, as long as you're not bothering anybody, go ahead and do it. If you want to live and have a bizarre lifestyle, you can do that. But if you want to be a perfectly bourgeois person, you can do that also. The thick libertarian version would say, yeah, but, you know, if you want to be a real friend of liberty, it's not enough just to go after the state. You've got to go after all the social obstacles that stand in the way of the full expression of my individuality, my individual choice to embrace different kinds of lifestyles. We have to go after all forms of oppression of the individual. So the message then becomes muddied. Instead of just clearly non-aggression, it becomes, well, we have to contribute to the overall flourishing of human beings or something.
Right.
And then the message gets obscured. Do you see any parallel here in the thinking of Mill?
Oh, absolutely. Well, because one of Mill's chief significances is that he changes the classical liberal understanding of the proper role of government in society. You know, classical liberalism is essentially on the side of what you call thin libertarianism, that the great enemy is abuse of power by government, arbitrary coercion by government, and that the whole movement was to put limits on the power of government, the organized agent of coercion. Well, Mill changes that. He scorns and dismisses that and mocks that as being absurd. And he says, no, the great purpose of government is what's his famous line, quote, the improvement of mankind. Well, that is an open sesame for any kind. I mean, that's a never-ending eternal project that justifies all kinds of governmental coercion. So it seems to me, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but that sort of thick libertarianism you discussed sounds more like Mill's project of eliminating all sources of possible repression of individuality and so forth. I think that comes from Mill and not from classical liberalism.
Yeah, this is a problem, and he's a bad influence in a number of ways, I think. But let's focus, though. Let's get into this religion of humanity stuff. Now, you're right that he's following in the footsteps of Comte, whose religion of humanity, maybe you might describe some of the outward trappings of it, because I find it incredibly creepy the way it institutionally reflects Catholicism in the saints and the sacramental system and so on.
Right. Well, Mill will reject all that. You know, Mill grew up in a Protestant tradition, and so he has no affinity for Comte's ritualistic institutionalization.
Right.
But the essence of it spoke directly to Mill's deepest motivations. He converts, really. He recounts in these letters what can only be regarded as a conversion experience in 1841. He says, I always saw in the idea of humanity the only idea capable of replacing that of God. But it is a long way from that to what I experience today, that the time is at hand. It's time now for his lifelong goal was to eliminate a theological or theistic orientation and redirect spiritual aspirations confined to the limits of this world. He is one of the many such thinkers of the 19th century who are attempting to create a social, secular, naturalistic, or political religion to replace a theological orientation which they regarded as moribund, obsolete, and corrupt. You know, you have to put Mill in the context of a larger picture. You know, in my field, there's a huge literature discussing. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Eric Voegelin. And,
oh, sure.
Right. You know, my book is full of Voegelinian themes because I think Voegelin is the best on this issue of the crisis of modernity. You know, we're talking about the age of totalitarianism, the most barbaric century in history in the 20th century, and how did all of this emerge? And Voegelin says, in the end, it's the result of a kind of spiritual pathology. He traces back even to the late Middle Ages, but this picks up militant steam in the 18th and 19th century, the attempt to obscure reality, the transcendent dimension of reality, and confine all existence to this world, the mundane world. And so you see this in all kinds of thinkers in the late 18th and 19th century, starting with the French Revolution, and then, of course, there's Hegel and Comte and Marx and so forth, who are, you know, the drama of atheist humanism. God is dead, says Nietzsche, at the end of the 19th century. This is the big news of modernity. Well, it's well known about these other thinkers who are engaged in this process of truncating reality, so to speak, to that the only thing that exists is this world. And, of course, what emerges, as Nietzsche says, is the new idol. When God is dead, man becomes God, right? This is the great overarching theme of modernity, the great crisis of modernity. I think that's Voegelin's view. I think it's correct. And Mill, what I discovered in Mill, is completely engaged in that same project. And that's what was new about the book. People had not recognized that in Mill because no one had done anything on his private religious thought. But he was thoroughly committed to creating a secular, naturalistic, as he puts it, purely human religion without a God to replace the theistic and theological orientation traditional of Western civilization. And the argument is, and this is for people who are friends of liberty, is that, you know, the free society emerged only in Western civilization. It's not coincidental. There's something about the West, Western civilization, that is unique, that for some reason the quest for liberty emerged there and only there, for individual liberty as we understand it. And if you do any research into this, you see that it is a product in some way of the biblical Judeo-Christian inspiration. And liberty has only taken root and spread to societies that were somehow informed by that worldview. Well, all of our institutions, all the institutions of freedom, and certainly in the American case, explicitly, are dependent implicitly upon something like the Judeo-Christian conception of existence and the nature of the individual person. None of it makes sense in the absence of those presuppositions. And therefore, this modern revolt against God, as Camus put it, is bound up with the crumbling of traditional constitutionalism, with traditional American understanding of the free society. And so we see this unraveling. You know, the, of course, the more virulent manifestation were the ideological movements of the 20th century, but the same phenomenon has also affected Anglo-American society. We didn't have Stalin and Hitler and gulags and concentration camps, but we got there was secular humanism, which is the modern-day name for the religion of humanity. We got social gospel, American progressivism, and all the rest of it, and we are seeing the gradual unraveling of our traditions, of the free society. And that's deeply bound up with this religious shift in modernity. It's not really a shift. It was pursued by militant activists who were determined to, as Bentham says, we want to eradicate even the very idea of religion from the minds of man. You know, the whole idea that there is a law above the king, right, a higher law than government, becomes increasingly obscure. And I think we are today living in the, we are still witnessing the unraveling of this spiritual foundation of the free society. So that's why Mill becomes, I grew to have such contempt for Mill, because he is totally bound up in this, caught up in this process.
All right, but I want you to tell me, to describe for us, what does the religion of humanity demand of me? And secondly, okay, is the religion of humanity like a religion in the senses to which we are accustomed to using that word, or does it have any outward trappings, or is it just a way of thinking?
Well, it doesn't have many outward trappings. Mill was not much for, you know, you don't have to go to a particular, you know, they used to have temples to humanity, though, up in New England in the end of the 19th, early 20th century. This was all over, this was all out in the open at that time. And there were books. There's an American author who wrote a book at the time called Religion of Humanity. I mean, this was in everybody's mouth. Here's the way to understand it. Anytime you think of God, just cross that out and replace what Comte called the great being of humanity, the source of existence, the end of all spiritual striving, the way to achieve spiritual fulfillment is not union with God, but it is instead union with the great being of humanity. You hear Woodrow Wilson is a perfect, he was a perfect disciple of this religion. Service to humanity, says Mill, is to become, quote, the law of our lives. He sometimes calls the religion of humanity the religion of duty, right? What Mill is about is an intense socialization process where you get children, and he even says it's from infancy, and you train them up to believe that their spiritual fulfillment will be met in serving other people. This is, of course, absent any kind of larger, you know, transcendent orientation. And so everything is to be directed, socialized, but you can't even, he says, you want to make people such that they can't even conceive of any benefit to themselves that is not simultaneously shared by all others. This is the social ethic, socialism, social religion. Comte coined the term altruism. Live for others was the slogan of the religion of humanity, right? And so Mill has this, there's a moral collectivism in Mill, if you read him in Utilitarianism. He says, this is why I'm so stunned, actually, that people still continue to regard Mill as a friend of liberty. He says, the utilitarian standard is not about the happiness of the individual, but the happiness of all concerned, the greatest happiness of the greatest number. And individuals may have to be sacrificed to that end. He's very clear about that. And here's the thing. He envisions, for Mill, liberty was a merely provisional value. See, you read on liberty. I'm sure you've read on liberty.
Yeah, a long time ago, but I'm sure I have, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's such a famous and evocative essay. I remember as a graduate student, you read this and you love it. And what we do is we read into it our own passion for liberty, and we think, we feel Mill's passion. Well, it's a very passionate essay, but if you read Mill's other writings of the era when he discusses the purpose of that essay, he understood that at his time in history, he believed that it was essential to have the most radical liberty of discussion. Right, but that's really the essence of that book. And why? Because he believed that the only reason Christianity, people still clung to Christianity was because it was a topic that was forbidden to be rationally criticized. You know, it was against the law in England at that time. Christianity was regarded as a as part of the British Constitution, it was considered blasphemous libel to criticize Christianity. So he is pushing as hard as he can against that convention. In order, he believed that if Christianity was subjected to acid criticism, that it would just dissolve more quickly. And so he's pushing, it's provisional, so he's authentically pushing for liberty in that essay, but he believes, then he goes on to say, that this, as he picked up from Comte and all these other thinkers, you know, who accepted a philosophy of history, that history has a goal and it's moving toward a final stage and all of that. Well, of course, for Marx, it was communism. For Comte and Mill, it was the final positivist or post-theological age that was in the offing. And that's coming up, and that's going to be unified by this. Christianity is going to die, and there's going to be a new religious or spiritual ethos that is propagated from birth. That's religion of humanity. And Mill's utilitarianism is the moral arm of that religion. It's the new ethics, the new purely human ethics that's going to be created, not by, you know, not some Mill dismisses, not a theological morality, but created by the best and brightest human beings, right, who are going to establish the new standards of morality. And everyone is going to be trained from infancy to absorb this new ethos, this new social, naturalistic, purely human ethos. And it's going to result in the final state, the positivist state. There's Mill conceives an end to history, as Marx does. And so Mill starts worrying. He starts worrying. He says, well, you know, yes, we're going to get to this final state, and everybody's going to be unified by this commitment to humanity. But then he says he worries because he understands that the true commitment requires struggle and contest. So we're going to have to create some institution like the devil's advocate to keep people's, you know, fervor alive for serving humanity in this final state. But there's not going to be liberty at that end. Everybody is going to be subscribe to this new ethos, this new religious ethos. Mill is he's quite clear about it. And so,
Let me ask you this. I mean, one of his complaints about Christianity is he describes it as a religion of rewards and punishments. And
that means
that you can't be engaged in purely selfless behavior, because if you're doing good, it's because you're trying to build up credit in heaven. But on the other hand, how can somebody raised in the Protestant tradition think that way about Christianity when the whole point of Luther and Calvin was precisely to say Christianity is not a system of rewards and punishments?
Yeah, well, Mill actually knew very little about Christianity, and he never took the time to study or think about it. He was raised by his father. Let's not even go there. James Mill. I mean, it's hard not to feel sorry for Mill. I mean, James Mill was really a demon. I mean, you know, and James Mill also, he had lost his faith early and became a committed atheist, as was Jeremy Bentham. See, Mill had been trained up as a, you know, people don't know this about Bentham. Bentham says that utilitarianism, Bentham's version, was consciously constructed as an alternative religion. He says, I guess a new religion needs a new name. I propose utilitarianism. See, Bentham had the exact same aspirations as Comte and the Mills. Even the substance of it was very similar. The point was, I mean, Bentham writes this essay, An Analysis of the Temporal Happiness of Mankind. Does religion contribute to man's temporal happiness? And of course he concludes, no. So therefore it has to be dismissed. And utilitarianism is the new purely human standard to replace these theistic standards. And so James Mill was the great apostle of Bentham, and he trained Mill up from birth. You know that story. You know Mill's autobiography where poor Mill had to sit at his father's knees by the time he was 1 year old, and his father trained him up. Mill was supposed to be the new experiment in making new men, as the way James Mill put it. He had been impressed by the thought of the 18th century French, the Helvetius, who had, you know, this sort of a Skinnerian rewards and punishment system that you can make human nature is, you know, God is dead. Human nature is totally plastic. You can make up any kind of men you want. All you have to do is have control over the administration of rewards and punishments. You reward the behavior that you want, and you punish the behavior you don't. So John Stuart Mill was his father's first experiment at making new men, although they intended to spread this out to, you know, through legislation to society as a whole. And so Mill was absorbed from his father the hatred of Christianity. And he never, and Mill says, it's kind of pathetic. He says at one place, he says, when he's in his late 30s, he says, my conscience always spoke to me in my father's voice. He never freed himself from that hegemony of his father over his mind. Mill was a pathetic figure in many ways, but every time I start feeling sorry for him, his overwhelming arrogance comes up, and it's impossible to sustain pity. But so Mill didn't really know anything about Christianity or really care. He was committed to this militant, it's all about, I mean, I can only, none of us will ever know for certain why in the 19th century this phenomenon rises to social significance, where so many millions of people that the thread of traditional faith snapped, and you instead see this militant drive for man to become God, to control the world, to define morality, they create the prisons of the 20th century. The ideological movements were driven by such secular messiahs all over the place. And Mill is one of them, sadly. But then that's how Mill was actually more effective in Anglo-American society than a Comte or Marx, who really spoke in an idiom alien to the Anglo-American tradition. But Mill knew the liberal tradition. He had grown up in the class, so he was able to take that same symbolism and twist it and manipulate it in such a way to lead to the end, the same end as those others, but I think much more effective in Anglo-American society. America, like I said, didn't have gulags and so forth, but we get secular humanism and our own version of the new idols.
Well, the book is John Stuart Mill and the Religion of Humanity. We've been talking to Linda Rader. Linda, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for this very, very interesting book. I hope you're able to make great progress on the magnum opus that you're working on now, in spite of having the heavy teaching load. We wish you all the best. I beg your pardon?
Freedom in American Society is the name of the new book, and it's a different approach. So anyway, thank you again for thinking of me, and I've enjoyed so much talking to you.
Well, thanks. Well, when that comes out, drop me a line, and we'll bring you back.
I will. Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody, one quick thing. I may be pushing back the release of my forthcoming book, which is called Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. I may push it back a week just because I want all the formats ready at once, the paper, the Kindle, and the audiobook. And I didn't realize the audiobook people require such a long time to examine the files and make sure it's of good quality and all that. And I don't want to be releasing it piecemeal. I want all the formats available on the same date. So I may push it to October 6th or thereafter, but it won't be much longer than that. It's just a matter of getting that audiobook format ready to go on the release date. And remember, one of the goodies you guys get, you guys who've been supporting the show, is the Kindle edition of that book when it comes out. So make sure and support us. If you like the show, go ahead and support us at supportinglisteners.com. Help me pay the bills here. Help me keep this thing going, because we got a good thing going here, my friends. Eric Peters tomorrow. We're going to talk about cars, libertarianism, and cars and libertarianism. It's going to be fantastic. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.